Our book of the week, the new biography of T.S. Eliot. Tom is studying, ever refining his poetic voice, and meeting two significant women in Young Eliot by Robert Crawford.
Tom met Emily Hale at his cousin Eleanor Hinckley's house. Shrewd, musical and elegant, Emily had the polite manners of an upbringing in Chestnut Hill, just outside Boston, and of her several single-sex schools. On the wintry Massachusetts evening of 17th February 1913, Emily Hale sang several songs at the beginning of The Stunt Show, held in Eleanor's home. The evening was carefully choreographed and full of teasing. Mr. Thomas Eliot, that would-be Parisian, found himself cast as Monsieur Marcel in a sketch Eleanor had written specially. Monsieur Marcel and his latest Marvel. Emily was positioned as star of the show. In this house that he had known from childhood, Tom listened to Emily singing a song called Ecstasy and was smitten with her. Yet by the start of 1914, he had clear plans to leave for Europe that summer, having been awarded the Sheldon Travelling Fellowship by Harvard. About 2 years after meeting her, Tom managed to tell Emily that he was in love with her. Having made a declaration of what he felt, he found her response crushingly disappointing. Probably in his excitement and nervousness, he misread elements of the situation. Aged 22, in the summer of 1914, Emily, who later made it clear to friends that she did love Tom, was perhaps inexperienced in relationships with suitors, and didn't give Tom a signal that he could interpret as encouragement. They went on being friends, and she remained unmarried. As months and then, unexpectedly, years kept them apart, each thought of the other with longing. It was something they could never put right. In October 1914, Tom headed for Merton College, Oxford, to resume his philosophical studies. War was denuding Oxford of its students. Among the Britons who started at Merton alongside Tom, over half would be killed. Tom wrote to Eleanor, "I should have liked to go into the officer training corps myself, but they won't take a foreigner." Tom's room was in the St. Albans Quadrangle. Though the oldest of Merton's four quadrangles dates from the 13th century, the latest St. Albans buildings had been reconstructed in 1910, so their plumbing, while not up to American standards, was in advance of the rest of the college. Merton hygiene could be unideal. Unfazed by its Spartan regime, Tom boasted to Eleanor, "I think I am the only man in the college who takes cold baths." A college servant asked him, "Do you keep it up all winter, sir?" To Tom, English working-class accents were exotic. Cold baths or not, Oxford was exceedingly comfortable and delightful, and very foreign. He knew some other Americans in Oxford. Along the road at Magdalen College, Schofield Thayer, familiar from Milton and Harvard, had come, like Tom, to study philosophy. Tom renewed his acquaintance. Soon he lent Thayer his friend Conrad Aitken's new poetry collection. Rigorous study of Aristotle and regular tutorials required antidotes. Tom took up rowing. He described himself at Oxford to Aitken as "contented and slothful, eating heartily, smoking and rowing violently upon the river in a four-oar." He also belonged to a small undergraduate poetry group, the Coterie, headquartered nearby in Beaumont Street. A few members had already published books or pamphlets. Others were about to do so. Some of these people were enthusiasts for French symbolist verse. Among them was a gangly, rather cynical, short-sighted undergraduate from Balliol College, Aldous Huxley. To these fellow students, Tom read aloud
The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. "We were startled," fellow undergraduate Eric Dodds recalled, "and yes, a little puzzled, but less puzzled than excited." In March, at a lunch party in Schofield Thayer's rooms, Tom met vivacious 26-year-old Vivian Haig Wood. Born in 1888, she was a young woman exactly the same age as himself. Slim, dark-haired Miss Haig Wood was a talented artist. Soon, on Saturday nights, he was spending time in London, where one could go to dance parties in big hotels. Vivian, Tom recalled, had a genius for dancing. To his delight, he found his American style gave him an almost dangerous appeal. "I terrified one poor girl, she is Spanish at that, by starting to dip in my one step," he informed Eleanor, mentioning also two other women, very good dancers, who caught the American style very quickly. Vivian was Schofield Thayer's friend when Tom met her. Yet her relationship with Thayer was problematic. She was keener than he to take things further before he was due to return to America. Tom, too, was due to leave for the States that summer. On the 23rd of June, the president and fellows of Harvard had appointed him once more an assistant in philosophy for the coming session. Yet he sent in his resignation. About 10 days after Thayer sailed from England, and without either Vivian or Tom telling the respective parents, on the 26th of June, they were married by a special license at Hampstead Register Office. Almost secret, it was in its way a sudden elopement. Vivian was on the rebound. So in a subtler way was Tom. He had by no means forgotten Emily Hale. Just as each of them had felt rebuffed, so both he and Vivian were eager for erotic experience. Poetry-loving Vivian, failing to secure her handsome literary-cum-philosophical beau, Thayer, was attracted by Thayer's striking, even cleverer friend, Tom. Eager to lose his virginity and his suppression, Tom had long been uncertain whether he could put his commitment to poetry before his predicted career as a philosopher. He had wondered about staying in England rather than returning to be immured in American academia. In marrying Vivian, he cut through all his problems at a single stroke, or so it seemed. Later, he wrote, "I came to persuade myself that I was in love with her simply because I wanted to burn my boats and commit myself to staying in England." When he wrote these words, almost half a century afterwards, he knew it had all been a disastrous mistake, not only for himself. He recorded, "To her, the marriage brought no happiness. To me, it brought the state of mind out of which came the wasteland." His family took the news of his marriage badly. The consensus was that Tom had been caught by Vivian. Bertrand Russell, who dined with the newlyweds on the 9th of July, wrote this devastating account to his married lover, Lady Ottilyn Morell. "Friday evening I dined with my Harvard pupil Elliot and his bride. She is light, a little vulgar, adventurous, full of life. An artist, I think he said, but I should have thought her an actress. He is exquisite and listless. She says she married him to stimulate him, but finds she can't do it. He is ashamed of his marriage." And very grateful if one is kind to her. 3 weeks later, finding herself alone, Vivian, while enjoying what she called her very nice status as Mrs. Stearns Elliot, wrote to Schofield Thayer telling him she had had blessings called down on my head as the poet's bride. She also let Thayer know how he is all over me, is Bertie. and I simply love him. Russell had just invited her to dinner. An older man, highly experienced in seduction. Russell made his move as soon as Tom was off the scene. The poet's parents were refusing to visit London, and the Elliots had summoned their son home. Too frightened of the voyage and the submarines, Vivian would not undertake the crossing. Tom went alone. In August 1915, his parents tried to talk him out of his determination to stay in England. It would be folly to throw away Harvard. Vivian sent a message to Eastern Point that she was very ill, convincing Tom that he must sail at once for England. "I fought like mad to keep Tom here," Vivian wrote later, "and stopped his going back to America." She and Bertrand Russell had been making plans. Vivian and Tom would move into the spare bedroom in Russell's London flat. Having succeeded in using her illness to retain Tom, Vivian established a pattern that would be repeated over the ensuing years. Tom would learn to respond with illnesses of his own and by stealing himself. Vivian was proud to be the wife of a poet whose fame is rapidly increasing through the length and breadth of more than one land. However, in order not to become merely T.S. Eliot's wife, Vivian was embarking on a career in ballet. She went to practice in an underground Soho room, where she wore a short black skirt, and Bertie or Tom came to watch her. Joking, she told Thea, "We have more or less of a triple menage." Having moved out of Bertie's London quarters, the Elliots were now in a rented flat at 3 Culworth House in St. John's Wood. Vivian was ill all winter. Her troubles were assumed to involve nerves, hysteria, colitis, neuralgia, stomach cramps, migraines and other ailments. She always felt exhausted by her illnesses. So did Tom. To give him a change of scene, in early April, Russell took him on his first visit to Garsington Manor House, where Lady Ottoline hosted gatherings of an avant-garde elite. Tom did not shine. A disappointed Lady Ottoline, conscious of the attraction between Russell and his former student's wife, nicknamed the young poet the Undertaker, and described his tense, guarded demeanour in her journal. "T.S. Eliot, his American poet friend, came with Bertie. I was very excited that T.S. Eliot was coming with him, but I found him dull, dull, dull. He never moves his lips but speaks in an even and monotonous voice, and I felt him monotonous without and within. Where does his queer, neurasthenic poetry come from, I wonder? From his New England Puritan inheritance and upbringing?" She concluded, "I think he has lost all spontaneity and can only break through his conventionality by stimulants of violent emotions."
Tomorrow, Tom starts work in a city bank and the wasteland begins to take shape. Tom Mannion is reading From Young Eliot by Robert Crawford, and the producer is Duncan Minchell.
Exploring European lives and cultures through their best-selling fiction.
"I knew he longed to go back to the time when we first met, when we would walk, bathed in golden light through the streets of my childhood home in Colobin, discovering each other and who we could be together."
Beginning in France with the award-winning novel Three Strong Women by Marie Ndiaye.
"Now he worried I no longer even wished to hear the sound of his voice. The voice that had offended me that morning by saying the words that can't be unsaid. Go back to where you come from."
Reading Europe begins on Sunday afternoon at 3 and then available on the Radio 4 website.
And we'll hear from Marie Ndiaye, the author of Three Strong Women, as part of a series of special reports from Paris on Front Row. The first of those reports is tonight at 7:15. Back to This Morning here on BBC Radio 4, and after the news in Woman's Hour, we'll meet some of the women working in construction. We'll also look at parenting in Shakespeare's plays today, focusing on disobedient daughters. Jenny Murray will be here in a couple of minutes.